Melvin, they have to if you're innocent.
I've been innocent for 20 damn years, he snapped. What difference did that make?
I mean, if there is definite proof of your innocence, they can't keep you in prison.
Oh, yeah? There's like a dozen dudes around the country. Their innocence was proved, like you said, years ago. Guess what? They're all still locked up. One dude, they said his time for appeal had run out, so he's screwed even though they know he didn't do it. Another guy, he served his time for crimes he didn't even commit, and because of some bullshit legal technicalities, they say he's got to serve 4 more years, and then maybe they'll let him out. Another dude, he punched out a guard, so he's got more time to serve, even though he never should have been in prison in the first place. So don't tell me they have to do anything. They do what they want. That's just how it is.
We will make sure that does not happen in your case.
She started packing up her things.
Now I have to go, but I'll be in contact with you as soon as I know anything.
As she rose, he looked up at her. I'm not mad at you, Mary. I'm just mad at everything right now.
I understand,
she said earnestly.
Believe me, I don't think I'd be nearly as calm as you.
The next moment she was gone. Marsh sat there until the guard came over and told him to get his ass up. The chains went back on. Reedy guard showed up and cattle prodded him in the back with his baton so hard he winced with pain. What'd your lawyer say, Jumbo? Asked Reedy. Mars, from long habit, said nothing. Oh, it's privilege, that's right. Just between you and her. You want to do her, Jumbo? Get you some white woman ass? Jump her bones? Used to be against the law, a black man doing that to a white woman. Still should be. White girl don't want no animal jumping her bones, right? He jabbed Mars again in the small of the back. Mars turned to look at him. When I'm out of here, let's have a drink, okay? I'll look you up. We'll hang out. Together. Reedy snorted and then stopped as the full import of Mars' words hit him like a semi. There were no more baton jabs on the way back to the cell. Chapter 7. When Bogart and Jameson returned at 1:30 that afternoon, Decker had showered, shaved, and put on his other set of clothes. Jeans, a flannel shirt under his sweater, and mud-stained boots on his feet. He had some dress clothes that he had purchased back in Burlington when he was pretending to be a lawyer, but they were dirty and at the bottom of his duffel. Bogart was in a crisp suit, starched dress shirt with a collar tab, and paisley tie. Jameson was in slacks and jacket and a cream-colored shirt with what looked to be brand-new stylish strappy heels on her feet. Compared to Decker's casual appearance, both looked ready to attend a wedding. But this was the best he could do, and they both seemed to appreciate that he'd made the effort. Ready? Said a smiling Bogart. Decker nodded. He was holding the binder, which he'd read and memorized. As they walked to Bogart's car, he felt his stomach start to squirm a bit, not from lack of food, but from nerves. The hitch with this whole arrangement was that Decker was not really comfortable dealing with other people. His hyperthymesia caused him to be aloof, awkward, and out of sorts in the company of others. He had no control over this. His mind had bent his personality to its will. It seems strange to think about your brain as being separate from the rest of you, but with a mind like Decker's, it just seemed like the logical thing to do. He had known that joining a team would require him to work with others, but now that the time was upon them, he was starting to question his decision to come here. Have I just royally screwed myself? He got in the front seat of Bogart's sedan and had to put it all the way back to accommodate his long legs. He used the full length of the seatbelt to stretch across his gut. Jameson sat in the back behind Bogart to give Decker as much room as possible. Can you tell me about the other team members? Asked Decker. Alex told me a little about Davenport. Lisa was brought on board because of her expertise dealing with psycho and sociopaths. She's very well known in her field and has written several books on the topic. She'll be able to analyze for us the personalities and tendencies of people at the center of our investigations, telling us what makes them tick. We have folks in the FBI who already do that, of course, but I think it's a good idea to get fresh eyes on a case outside the perspective of federal law enforcement.
Sounds like a workable theory,
noted Jameson. Then there's another FBI agent, Todd Milligan. Todd's in his mid-30s. He's a good field agent who competed for a slot on this team. He's excited to get started. And how does he feel about working with non-FBI agents? Asked Decker. There are no problems there, replied Bogart. Otherwise, he would have been vetted out. Decker caught Jameson's attention in the rear view. His expression indicated that he did not necessarily share Bogart's confidence on that point. 20 minutes later, they pulled up in front of a brick building on the grounds of the Marine Corps base Quantico, which also housed, among other things, the FBI Academy and Lab and VICAP. As they climbed out of the car, Bogart buttoned his jacket and said, VICAP gave us space in their facility to use. We'll also be operationally supported by them.
VICAP, Violent Criminal Apprehension Program,
said Jameson. Bogart nodded as he held the door open for them. Formed in 1985, they're a unit dealing with serial murders and other violent crimes, usually of a sexual nature. They're part of the Critical Incident Response Group, which is in turn part of the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime, noted Decker. Bogart nodded again. We have lots of organizational layers. Maybe too many, assessed Decker. Maybe, said Bogart curtly. They walked down a well-lighted corridor.
So how does what we're going to do differ from what VICAP already does?
Asked Jameson. VICAP is really a central database that other law enforcement agencies, both state and federal, use to investigate cases in their jurisdictions. There are teams of FBI agents that also investigate cases on the ground, of course. But ours will be one of the first to utilize folks from outside the FBI to be part of such an operational team. It took some finagling and negotiation. I have to say there are some in the Bureau who are not supportive of what we're doing and think bringing in outsiders is a mistake. I hope to prove them wrong. Decker said, playing devil's advocate, what if we prove them right? Bogart shrugged. Then our funding is cut and we go off and do something else, and my career slams right into the ceiling. Jameson said firmly,
then let's make sure that doesn't happen.
They passed through a security checkpoint, and then Bogart used his ID badge to open a door. Here we are, he said, gesturing them inside. Before Decker passed through the doorway, he felt the butterflies in his belly that he often had before stepping onto the gridiron. It was an unwieldy combination of nerves, adrenaline, and anticipation. He had thought those days were long since over. Obviously not. Here we go. He stepped into the room. Chapter 8. Decker's gaze swept the space and took everything in like radar bouncing off hard objects. Two people were there. Lisa Davenport was to his right. She was in her late 30s, with light blonde hair cut short, a lean, attractive face, full lips, and sparkling blue eyes. Her body was long and athletic, the hips narrow, the shoulders symmetrically broad. She smiled at Decker as his gaze passed over her. Todd Milligan sat across the table from her. He was about 6 feet tall and 180. Like Bogart, he was very fit and looked like he could run forever without getting winded. His dark hair was cut military short, his brow naturally furrowed, his light brown eyes intense, his spine assuredly as straight as his striped tie. There was nothing inviting or welcoming about the man. He just looked permanently serious. In front of each was a thick binder. Decker noted the myriad post-it notes sticking out from the binder's sides. Both Davenport and Milligan had evidently come prepared. Bogart made the introductions, and they all sat. On the wall was a large screen TV that neatly filled the space. Bogart fired up a laptop that sat in front of him and manipulated some keys. The TV screen came to life, and they all focused on it. Bogart said, we currently have 20 cases lined up to look at. Of those, we will be able to realistically focus on only one at a time. I'm going for quality, not quantity. The 20 cases you've been given have been whittled down from a far larger number using various internal filters. Milligan said in a firm, clear voice, it seems to me that the Murillo case has a lot of potential. I have some angles for approaching it that I think are rock solid. Good to hear, said Bogart. But I wanted to go through a brief overview of each of the cases, so we're all starting from the same page. Milligan's features tightened just a bit. Decker could tell he was not pleased at what he no doubt saw as a rebuke, though Bogart was actually being perfectly reasonable. Bogart methodically ran through each case, the highlights of which were shown on the screen. Decker noted that each of the others followed along in their binders. He saw Milligan glance over at him in mild surprise because Decker had not even cracked open his book. Perhaps Bogart had not told them about Decker's hyperthymesia. He was following along in his mind, turning the mental page in his head in sync with what Bogart was doing on the screen. When Bogart was done, he looked around the room. Comments? Milligan said, I still believe the Morello case is the one to go after Ross. It offers the best chance of a successful intervention. The case against him isn't that strong, and one critical piece of evidence was for all intents and purposes ignored. It seems to me that there are better suspects out there, and it would be good for your program to get off to a strong start. Bogart looked at the others. Views on that? Decker said, I think we should pass on the Morello case. Why? Milligan asked sharply. Because it's extremely likely that he's guilty. As Milligan looked at him, his thick neck seemed to flare out like a cobra's. Based on what? He asked. Inconsistencies. Such as? Morello was a civilian contractor to the Navy. On page 2 of the statement, he told police that he left for work at Crane Naval Base in Martin County, Indiana, at 9 a.m. He said he arrived at the base at 8:15 a.m. That's because, Milligan began triumphantly, only Decker ignored him and plowed on. That's because at that time, Martin County and the Naval Base had been switched to the Central Time Zone from the Eastern Time Zone, effective April 2, 2006. Thus, it was 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time when Morello left his house, but 8 a.m. Central Standard Time. Correct, Milligan admitted grudgingly. So what's the inconsistency? Morello had a motive for killing the victims, but there was one witness for Morello, Bahiti Sadat. He said that he saw Morello on the street across from his shop at 6:15 p.m. The murders, forensic and other evidence determined, occurred at 6:19. Since the murders were committed about 10 miles from Sadat's shop, and Morello was on foot at the time, it was a solid alibi for Morello. But the police mostly discounted that because Sadat was Muslim, interjected Milligan. And this was right in the middle of the wars in the Middle East, and there was a lot of prejudice. Sadat's testimony was rock solid. It gave Morello an alibi, but the jury wouldn't buy it. He paused, scrutinizing Decker. I hope you don't have those sorts of prejudices. Decker ignored this, too, and continued. Sadat said he had just finished his evening prayer. That's when he said he saw Morello. He remembered it distinctly because he had just looked up from his prayer rug and through the window of his storefront. He made a positive ID. Exactly, said an increasingly impatient Milligan. You're making my case for me. Decker said, The prayer Sadat said he had just finished was the Maghrib, the fourth prayer of the day. Right. Devout Muslims pray 5 times a day. We all know that, pointed out Milligan. Well, actually, lots of people don't know that, and back then a lot more folks probably didn't, said Decker. But the point is, the Maghrib prayer cannot commence before sunset. The religion is strict on that. And on that day in Indiana, sunset was at 7:12 p.m., nearly an hour later than Sadat testified he saw Morello pass by the shop as he looked up. Now, Sadat is only human. And if he'd been off by a few minutes, I don't think anyone could blame him. But at that time of day, the sun would still clearly be in the sky. No Muslim would have begun their sunset prayer when it was so clearly not sunset. And certainly no Muslim would have finished the sunset prayer nearly an hour before the sun had even gone down. Milligan's jaw dropped slightly. Bogart and Jameson shared a glance. Davenport kept her gaze locked on Decker. Decker added, And in addition to that, according to the drawing the police made that was in the file, the front of Sadat's shop faces west toward the street where Morello was allegedly walking at the time. Jameson said,
And Muslims face east when praying, toward Mecca.
Bogart added, Sadat's back would have been to Morello. When he looked up from his prayer rug, he couldn't have seen him. I'm surprised no one thought to question that. Decker said, A lot of Americans don't know that much about Muslim customs. And they knew even less back then, when most couldn't tell you the difference between a Sunni and a Shia. I think you might find Morello and Sadat know each other, and that this alibi was prearranged, even though it didn't work. It might determine conclusively that Murillo was guilty, but since he's in prison where he belongs, you might not want to waste your time. Milligan sat back, looking extremely miffed. Decker glanced at Bogart. Can we talk about the Melvin Mars case now? Wait a minute, barked Milligan. I was told you just got here today. Were you sent the briefing book earlier? Bogart answered, No, he got it this morning. I delivered the binder myself. Milligan turned back to Decker. And from all these cases, you dug up detailed stuff like that on the Murillo case in, what, a few hours? I didn't have to dig anything up. I read the statements and reports. It was all right there. And knowing the specific Muslim prayers, said Milligan. Decker shrugged. I read a lot. And the sunset timing, persisted Milligan. I'm from that part of the country. I knew that off the top of my head. Milligan said, From a specific day in 2006? Yes, said Decker imperturbably. Milligan said accusingly, Did you know beforehand that I was interested in the Murillo case? Until I walked in this room, I didn't even know you existed, replied Decker matter-of-factly. He looked at Bogart again. Can we discuss the Mars case now? Because I don't really think any of the others in the binder are nearly as compelling. And since Sadat was lying, and Murillo killed those people, and we're not here to free the guilty, I think we need to move on. Davenport had to cover her mouth to hide her smile, even as Milligan stared venomously at Decker. Before Bogart could speak, Davenport said,
I vote that we take up the Mars case.
Decker eyed her curiously. But I haven't described it yet.
After what you just did, Mr. Decker, I'll take it on faith.
She looked at Bogart.
Ross, can we go ahead and vote?
Bogart glanced at Jameson and Decker and then said, Okay. All in favor of taking on the Melvin Mars case, raise your hand. Four hands went up. Milligan was the lone dissenter. Decker leaned forward. Good. Now can we get down to it? Chapter 9. 2 hours later, the meeting ended and plans were made to reconvene the next day. As they left the building, Davenport caught up to Decker and Jameson. Bogart had stayed behind for a few minutes to talk to Milligan.
Do you two have time for a drink?
Asked Davenport, her gaze swiveling between the pair.
There's a place about a 5-minute drive from the base.
Jameson looked uncertain.
We drove over with Agent Bogart. He can meet us there, I can text him. I just wanted to talk about the case some more, before tomorrow. Then he or I can drive you back. I have a car.
Jameson looked at Decker.
You okay with that?
Decker said, Does the bar serve food? I didn't have any lunch.
Absolutely,
Davenport said, running her gaze over Decker's large physique. Let's go then, he said. It was called, aptly, the Dive, a hangout for soldiers and cops and rednecks in the occasional suit. Decker's party took a table in the back, farthest away from the bar, which was already loud and crowded on New Year's Day. Davenport snagged a seat right next to Decker, while Jameson sat across from them. They had a fourth chair for Bogart, whom Davenport had texted. He said he would meet them there in about 20 minutes. They ordered beers and some snacks. Decker got a mound of chili chips and cheese for himself. Davenport had some flatbread and Jameson French onion soup. Davenport said,
I thought the first meeting went well, although Milligan seemed a bit brusque. Territorial,
noted Jameson.
I'm not sure he's into us outsiders being involved in FBI investigations. Well, he's going to have to get used to it,
replied Davenport. She took a sip of beer and studied Decker, who had already dug into his chip mound.
That was quite impressive what you did back there, Amos. Do you mind if I call you Amos?
Decker swallowed some of his food. Without looking at her, he said, I didn't want to waste time on a case of no interest, and you can call me Amos.
But you are interested in the Melvin Mars case, clearly.
Yes.
When you were talking about the case, you said you played football against him in college. Is that what piqued your interest? Or was it the fact that his case parallels what happened to you in Burlington? You didn't mention that in the meeting.
Decker slowly lifted his gaze from his food to look at Davenport as Jameson stared suspiciously at her. I didn't mention it because it had no real relevance to whether we should take the case or not, he replied.
Come on, Amos,
said Davenport.
A mind like yours, hyperthymesia coupled with synesthesia due to a traumatic brain injury suffered on the football field? You're way too smart not to see that connection.
Bogart told you that? He said. She nodded.
I got here a week ago. Gave me time to get acclimated and have some nice discussions with Ross. He had just come off the case with you, and he was generous with details, seeing as how I was joining the team and all. I'm still not sure he should have told you about it,
said Jameson defensively. Davenport held up her hands in mock surrender.
Please don't get the wrong idea. Ross didn't tell me everything, but enough so that I know there are parallels between the murders of Amos's family and Melvin Mars's parents. I think it could be a fascinating case study.
But he told you about my condition, said Decker.
Well, yes, I'm a clinical psychologist by profession, Amos, with a subspecialty in the arena of cognitive anomalies, and I actually know some of the people at the Cognitive Research Institute outside of Chicago, though this was well after you went through there.
Decker wiped his mouth with a napkin. But the goal would be to determine guilt or innocence in the Mars case, nothing more, nothing to do with my cognitive anomalies, because I have no interest in being a case study. Davenport fingered her beer.
If that's what you want. Frankly, I think it would be wasting an opportunity. But if I've put my foot in my mouth, I'm sorry. The last thing I wanted to do was offend you in any way. It was not my intent.
Decker shrugged but said nothing. A moment later, Bogart walked in and joined them. He sat down and a waitress came and took his order. After she left, Bogart said, I want to apologize for the meeting today. Milligan was out of line and I told him so. We're not in this to fight with each other. We're a team. And those who want to remain on the team will have to start acting like it. He had a case and he argued for it, said Decker. I took no offense. Well, he could have made his argument more professionally. The insinuation that you were somehow looking to purposefully torpedo his case was ridiculous. Bogart's glass of wine arrived and he took a sip. Lisa may have told you that I briefed her on some of what happened in Burlington.
She did,
said Jameson.
And she knows about Amos's condition,
she added a bit crossly. If Bogart noticed her resentment, he chose to ignore it.
And I was telling Amos that I've had dealings with the folks at the Cognitive Institute,
commented Davenport. But Ms. Davenport has assured me that my anomalies will have nothing to do with investigating the Melvin Mars case, added Decker. Davenport raised her beer.
Touché, and please, call me Lisa.
Bogart said, Mars is still in prison in Texas. It seems the first thing to do would be to go there. The place where his parents were killed is hundreds of miles west of the prison. And then we have Charles Montgomery in Alabama, said Decker. Exactly. Davenport said,
can we learn anything about this guy before we go to see him? Is there any possible connection between Mars and this Montgomery person?
Well, that's what the police are no doubt trying to determine, said Bogart. And let me tell all of you right off the bat, this will be very delicate. The state of Texas will not look kindly on federal intervention at this moment. Frankly, they may well question why we're even involved, and I can't promise that if pushback comes, we can stick it out. He looked at Decker. The cases in the binder were all pre-approved for our involvement, Amos. The Mars case obviously is not. But we can still look into it, said Decker. Yes, but I've found that as a general rule, Texans do not like people from Washington, D.C. messing in their affairs.
Can you access all the records on the case?
Said Jameson.
We should really go through all of that first. All we have is what Amos found online.
I can definitely make calls and see what I can do, replied Bogart.
Then we need to get in to see Mars,
added Davenport.
Meeting with him, I can give you a better insight as to his psychological makeup.
Agreed, said Bogart. He glanced at Decker. That was a good job back there on the Murillo case, Amos. You picked up on stuff again that everyone else missed. Decker had been staring off and not really following the conversation. He came out of his musings and said, we need to find out if Charles Montgomery has any family.
What? Why?
Asked Davenport. Decker didn't answer her. He just stared off again, thinking. After they finished at the bar, Jameson and Decker were dropped off at his place, where Jameson had left her car.
So that went reasonably well,
she said.
Although Milligan is a bit of a jerk.
She glanced at him.
What did you think?
I get where he's coming from.
And Davenport?
I'm sure she's competent,
But...
But she has her own agenda.
Meaning you.
Maybe. She looked him over.
There's a men's shop about a mile from here. It's open until 10, I checked.
Decker shot her a glance. Do I really look that bad?
Clothes make the man.
I'm pretty sure whoever said that did not have me in mind.
Shopping always makes me think better,
she said hopefully. And how exactly do I pay for new clothes? She held up a credit card.
Bogart gave me this, for essentials, which I confirmed includes clothes for you,
she added quickly.
And you'll have your salary.
Decker looked over at her. Salary?
I don't know about you, but I can't do this for free. Didn't you discuss money with Bogart?
Decker let out a sigh.
I'll take that as a no. But I can tell you that it's a lot more than either of us were making back in Burlington.
Really? Said Decker.
Really. And if this thing works out, we'll have to get our own housing. Can't stay on the base permanently. And you'll need a car to replace the rental.
I hadn't given any of that much thought.
Trust me, I could tell.
3 hours later, they walked out of the men's clothing store with numerous outfits for Decker. Nothing had to be altered. They had mainly just bought the biggest sizes the store had. Pants, shirts, shoes, socks, underwear, and a couple of jackets that were large enough to use as sails if need be. Jameson had helped coordinate the colors and accessories and commented on all the pieces that Decker tried on. As he stood in front of the tri-mirror, he had said, I look like a whale in a two-piece suit.
It's nothing you can't work on. There's a gym, a two-minute walk from where you're staying, and a track right next to it.
When he came out of the dressing room in his old duds, she held up a stack of workout clothes she had gathered for him, along with size 14 tennis shoes.
Does quadruple X work for you?
She asked. If they stretch enough, yeah. She drove Decker back to his place and helped him carry in the packages. I appreciate the help, he said.
I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
What, to be my personal shopper?
No, to have this shot with the FBI. Bogart never would have extended the invitation just to me. He let me tag along so you'd come too.
Give yourself some credit.
Oh, I plan to work my ass off proving myself. But you got me in the door.
You really think this will work out?
Who knows? That's part of the excitement.
I'm not sure I need any more excitement in my life.
Then I think you came to the wrong place.
Chapter 10 6 a.m. Decker blinked awake and sat up in his bed. He looked around for a few moments, unsure of where he was. Virginia. Quantico. The FBI gig. Right. He got up and padded to the bathroom. After that, he walked into the kitchen and looked out the window. It was still well dark. He slid out the coffee pot with the intent to make and drink a pot while he went over case notes. Then he looked down at his massive gut and the slight wheezing apparently caused by merely getting out of bed and taking a leak, and sighed. Shit, he muttered. He went back into his bedroom and pulled out the exercise clothes Jameson had bought for him. He put them on, thankful they had some give, and then bent down and tugged on his tennis shoes, which were each about the size of a newborn. He walked outside and down the steps of the apartment complex where he was staying. He looked left and saw the gym that Jameson was referring to. The lights were on, and he could hear sounds coming from within. Of course, type A's are already at it, and this place is full of type A's. He trudged slowly to the building and went in. He'd remembered to bring his ID. The young attendant at the front desk gave him a towel and a locker key. He returned the latter, but kept the towel. You look like you could squat in Abrams, said the young man, eyeing Decker's enormous girth. I do, every time I stand, replied Decker with another sigh tacked on as he took in the large exercise area where amazingly fit people of both genders were grinding it out with enviable ease. Decker found one corner, put down his towel, looked in the mirror once, and decided not to do so again. He did a little cardiovascular warm-up before stretching and found himself winded. He pushed on and performed his stretching. His years of doing this as a football player had made him more supple than he looked, but he was still pretty stiff right now. Places in his spine he hadn't felt in a long time started talking to him. But he was beginning to warm up. A young woman walked by. She had an FBI ID badge clipped to her Lycra shorts. She was pretty and supremely fit, and looked like fat would not dare attach itself to her body. When she saw Decker bend down and touch his toes and then lay his palms flat to the floor, she said,
"Impressive."
"Well, then I'd suggest you look away, because it's all downhill from here." She laughed and moved on. After limbering up, Decker hit the weights, did what he could until his muscles screamed at him, and then grabbed a medicine ball and did some core. He was really starting to sweat, and it actually felt good.
"Okay, I am totally impressed beyond belief."
He turned to see Jameson standing there in her workout gear. "You coming or going?" he asked.
"Going. I got here right when it opened. I was in another part of the gym. I was leaving when I saw you."
She smacked him on the arm.
"Way to go, Decker."
He put the medicine ball back and shrugged. "Little by little, right?"
"You want to walk back with me? My place is just a little bit down from where you are."
"I thought I'd walk around the track and cool down."
"Sounds good. I'll see you at the office. And Amos, have you checked out your pantry and fridge yet?"
I noticed there was stuff in there. She looked a bit sheepish.
"I did your grocery shopping before you got here. Don't kill me, but it's mostly healthy stuff. That's why I brought you that disgusting breakfast sandwich, sort of your last hurrah before going the healthy route."
"How healthy?" he wanted to know. She smiled uneasily.
"I'll let you have the pleasure of discovery. I'll pick you up about a quarter till."
She walked out. A few minutes later, Decker was done. He wiped his face and headed to the track, which was behind the gym and enclosed by a waist-high fence. He walked around the track at a faster-than-normal pace until he felt like his knees were about to quit on him. Then he slowed. His heart was beating fast and the sweat was still coming. He felt both good and exhausted. It was cold, and each of his breaths came out as tiny clouds. Then something blew past him so fast he almost fell down. He'd never seen the person coming. Todd Milligan turned around and jogged backwards as he eyed Decker. He was wearing Under Armour, and his physique was impressive. His six-pack was outlined against the compression fabric. "Hey, Decker, you might want to pick up the pace or else you'll get run over." He turned and sprinted away. The guy was fast and athletic, and a prick. A minute later, Decker heard someone else coming up behind him and wondered if it was Milligan looking to lap him. He was moving over to get out of the way when he heard the voice.
"Good morning."
Lisa Davenport jogged up to him and then stopped. She was in a warm-up suit. She put her hands on her knees and breathed in and out several long sequences.
"Good morning," said Decker.
She started stretching out her arms and legs.
"I just finished my run and saw you."
"I'm hard to miss, although Agent Milligan nearly ran into me. Go figure."
"I'm sure,"
she said dryly.
"I'm just making my way around the track. I did the gym first."
"Exercising gives me so much energy. I love it."
"Me too, as you can see."
She broke into a smile.
"But you played college and professional football. You must have been in fantastic shape."
"I was, a long time ago."
"But also more recent than that."
"Why do you say that?"
"You were a police officer and then a detective. You must have been in decent condition then, too."
Decker started walking again, and she matched his stride, or tried to.
"That seems like a long time ago, too."
"But it really wasn't. It was less than, what, 20 months ago?"
"You seem to know a lot about me."
"I'm a curious person, Amos, and you're a fascinating study."
"Why, because my brain got blown up so I can't forget anything and I see things in color folks don't normally associate with red, yellow, and blue?"
"It's my field. I can't pretend I'm not interested. You realize how rare you are?"
"I actually never thought about it."
She seemed to be about to say something, but then paused.
"Well, it was good seeing you. I'm going to grab a shower. See you at the office."
She turned and jogged off in the opposite direction. Decker watched her go for a long time, and then he waddled over and sat down on a bench next to the track. He let his heart rate go back to normal and then stood, reasonably sure that he was not about to suffer a stroke. He walked slowly back to his place, showered, and changed into some of his new clothes.
He had tried them on last night, but now they felt just a tad looser. Must be my imagination. He checked the fridge. Soy milk, fresh squeezed OJ, yogurt, apples, and a carton of organically grown eggs. The bread was 9-grain wheat. The chicken was extra lean. The ground meat was turkey. The butter was made with canola oil. There were also drawers of fresh vegetables. He looked in the pantry. Healthy cereal, low-sodium peanut butter, honey, low-sodium soups, organic pasta, something called orzo, bottles of vitamins, flaxseed oil, power bars, bananas, an energy drink that you mixed with water, and 2 dozen sport drinks in various flavors. There wasn't a bag of chips, block of chocolate, or tub of ice cream in sight. He filled a bowl with cereal that looked like twigs a squirrel had pooped out, and then poured soy milk over it and cut up a banana as his topper. Jameson had had mercy on him because there was coffee, but the cream was fat-free and the sugar was the brown unprocessed stuff Decker had seen but not used. Jameson had apparently confiscated the processed sugar he had used the day before. He made his coffee and carried his cup and bowl over to the table in the little dining area, sat down, and ate his breakfast. Well, that was filling, he thought as he rinsed the cup, bowl, and spoon. He checked his watch. The team was scheduled to meet in about a half hour. He had a bit of time to kill before Jameson came for him. He sat down in a chair and looked out the window onto a street that was bustling with activity. Quantico had lots of people coming and going at all hours, and now Decker was a little cog in this huge ecosystem. And did he want to be? Really? He closed his eyes, and though he didn't want to, his infallible memory whirred back to the deaths of his family in their house, to the months of agony he suffered afterward, and to the eventual tracking down and punishment of their killers. And then to the realization that even with that conclusion, he had never felt even a bit of closure. When he opened his eyes, they were moist, and he felt himself trembling. Time did not heal wounds for him. Not for someone who could never forget. Their murders were as fresh now as when they occurred. Not just the visuals, but also the emotional hatchet attached to the mental images. They would be until the day he died. He glanced out the window in time to see Jameson's tiny car pull up out front. He wiped his eyes, rose, and slapped himself a couple of times in the face. He could either live in the past, or he could venture out and see if he was capable of having a future. And some days, the decision would be easier than others. He headed to the door. Chapter 11. The rap on the door startled Mars. Then the door slot opened at the bottom. "Get your ass over here," said the voice. Mars obediently rose from his bunk, turned his back to the door, placed his hands behind his back, and slid down on his haunches until his hands were level with the slot. Handcuffs were attached to his wrists. Then he rose and stepped away from the door as it opened. It was Big Dick. He'd been here as long as Mars had, and the years had just made him meaner. Big Dick was so wide, his bulk filled nearly the entire opening of the cell door. A scowl and a smile fought for supremacy on his features. "What's going on?" Mars asked. "Shut up. I tell you to talk, boy." 2 other guards emerged from behind Big Dick and shackled Mars's feet. He was hustled down the corridor, his chains clanking like Marley's ghost. He passed walls of cells with faces looking out the square chicken-wired windows. Then he felt on his face the rush of Big Dick's foul breath, smokes mixed with whiskey. "You a lucky man," said Big Dick, his thick neck flexing rhapsodically with each syllable. "You off death row for now. You heading to Gen Pop. Folks will be glad to see your chocolate ass, Jumbo." Mars did not consider himself a lucky man. Going back to general population meant only one thing. He was heading to an unofficial execution. His own. If you wanted to survive in prison, there were strategies and tactics. If you wanted to kill someone, there were also strategies and tactics. His leaving his cell and the security of death row was the strategy. The tactics of his planned murder were about to be revealed.
He was led into another building. When the second door slammed shut with the shriek of automatic hydraulic rams doing their job, he was brought to a halt by the meaty hand of Big Dick on his shoulder. "Last stop, Jumbo." His handcuffs were removed, but not the leg shackles. Then the guards turned and left him. Mars looked around. Death Row was housed in Building 12, but he was now in the prison's open area with all the other inmates. The place was filled with convicts, some in pants, some shirtless, some in shorts cut from their prison pants. Though it was technically winter, it was stifling hot in here. Overhead fans spun away, but barely moved the thickened, humid, malodorous air that hung over them all, like a marine layer of toxic gas. A group of prisoners sat at tables bolted to the floor. Some stood conversing. Still others were doing push-ups, or else pull-ups on bars built into the walls. The stench of sweat, cigarette smoke, and the fuzzy must of prison alchemy drugs hit him like a wave. Guards hovered, their batons smacking lightly against calloused palms. Their eyes spun around the space, looking for signs of trouble, but they kept coming back to Mars. He was obviously the special guest today. The show was about to start. Everyone had good seats. The only thing missing was the popcorn. The prisoners had also turned to look at Mars. Those doing push-ups and pull-ups stopped. They wiped off their hands and moved back against the wall and waited. Their expressions were clear. "Thank God it's not me." The news had spread fast. Mars might be getting out after nearly being put to death. Getting out. Wasn't to be. At least not standing up. Mars rubbed his wrists where the shackles had cut into him. The pain was actually welcome right now. If you could feel pain, you were alive. That status could change, surely, but right now, he was breathing. He looked up one story to the catwalk that ran around the perimeter of the open area. Big Dick was up there staring down at him. The smile on his face was something to behold. Next to him was the runty Reedy, looking just as gleeful, the royals above, the gladiators below. Mars looked back at the group of prisoners watching him. Two in particular seemed to be paying him a good deal of attention. They were both white, bigger than he was, prison barbell muscled, tatted, bearded, crazy-eyed, with rotted teeth, strung out on the shit they smuggled in or made right here. Tweedledee and Tweedledum. Mars didn't know them or what crimes they'd committed to be sent here, but he could easily see that they were exactly where they belonged. They weren't humans. They were animals in a cage. But they weren't in a cage right now. They were right out in the open. "With me," thought Mars, "and my legs are chained." He stretched out his neck and felt a gratifying pop as a kink was relieved. Next, he eyed the field in front of him like he had as a running back, earning his future between the tackles in the old Southwest Conference, smashing into men bigger than he was, and yet almost always somehow winning the battle. He'd always divided the field into grids, planes of existence through which he had to navigate. He was blessed to have vision that saw everything all at once. That attribute was perhaps the rarest gift in sports, and he still had it even all these years later. His breathing slowed, his nerves calmed, his muscles relaxed. He felt good, actually. 20 years of my life. 20 damn years. The anger in him was suddenly immense, the frustration just as potent. Somebody had to pay, and somebody was about to. Jumbo was about to come down for an extremely hard landing. He shuffled forward with what seemed to be the intention of joining a couple of inmates. Mars knew the lay of the land, and the pair did what he expected them to do. They turned and walked off. Nobody mixed with the leper. The infection might rub off on you. He looked back up at the catwalk, at Big Dick and Reedy. He knew what they expected to see on his features. Fear. But instead, he smiled. And on their faces, he saw what he wanted to see. Surprise. He turned back to face D and Dumb, who had separated from the pack and were now circling him, wild dogs on the prowl. There were lots of wild dogs in Texas, and they always hunted in packs. They went after wounded animals, running them out of air, and then ganging up on them for the kill. Well, Mars was not wounded, and he had plenty of air. He wondered what their reward would be. Drugs, smokes, maybe a local skirt snuck in for an hour. Well, he would make them earn it. Dee and Dumb were both in their 30s, years younger than he was. They were tough, scarred, hardened. To a degree. It was always about degrees. He was about to find out where this pair stood on the prison hardiness spectrum. Mars shuffled toward Dee while keeping Dumb in his periphery. Dee was the linebacker, looking to take him head-on because he was big and strong and that was his job. Yet he looked a little surprised that Mars was coming right for him. Then his expression told Mars that he thought this a positive, that Mars was actually making his job easier. Maybe instead of Dee, he was actually Dumb. Now the other dude was the safety, the fail-safe. If Dee went down, Dumb was the one set to take Mars out of this world. From the corner of his eye, Mars watched Dumb. The dude was jacking himself up, getting ready. Part of him wanted his mate to fail, just so he could have his shot, build his cred inside here to unassailable proportions. He could hear it now. I took out Melvin Mars. Dude was a murderer, NFL lock, biggest, meanest cocksucker you ever saw, and I wiped the floor with his ass. He'd be telling that story in here for the next 40 years. Well, except for one thing. It was never going to happen like that. And Mars didn't think Dee and Dumb had 40 seconds, much less 40 years, left to live. Get ready. Fresh meat. 'Cause here comes Jumbo. What's up, brother? Said Mars to Dee. I ain't your brother, snarled Dee.
Know that, man. Just making conversation. Ain't no big deal, right?
Words did not come out of Dee's mouth. Instead, a shiv was revealed in his hand as he came at Mars with a burst of speed. The strike would be to his belly and up to his chest cavity. That was quick and clean, and the bleed-out would be fast and fatal and immensely painful. The prisoners and guards had backed away to give Dee room to work and Mars to fall. Well, they actually had it backwards. Mars had already lowered his shoulder, squatted down, tensed his enormous thighs, and despite the shackles, sprang forward like a launched cannonball. As his hand clamped around Dee's wrist, holding the shiv right where it was, his right delt slammed into Dee's throat, pushing his chin up at an angle that would cause nothing but a bolt of pain right before blackness. There came an audible crack as the spine was pushed past all point of return, and it was over, just like that. Bleeding from the mouth, an unconscious Dee crumbled where he stood, the shiv dropping from his hand. Linebacker down. Mars pointed to the blade as it hit the floor.
Hey, man got a blade, he said to the closest guard. Y'all be careful now. Somebody might get hurt.
He saw in his periphery what he expected to see. Dumb was hesitating now after the quick slaughter of his larger twin. But then how could he not follow through with all the dudes and especially Big Dick watching? Man had to go. No choice. Else he'd get a shiv in his gut later. Just how it was. America didn't have prisons. It had chaos pens where men were transported back 17 centuries, where the strong survived until it met something even stronger, and where the weak died every time. Dumb screamed and ran at Mars at the top of his speed. It was almost too easy, really. Dumb was all muscled up and yet slow as gravy, big in the arms, light in the quads. And the man was about to pay a steep penalty for that imbalance. Mars again bent low, pivoted, blocked Dumb's arm where his shiv was held, got his shoulder under Dumb's belly, and exploded upward. It was the same move that had launched 300-pound defensive linemen off their feet. The 250-pound Dumb went airborne, soaring over Mars. The crowd parted, and Dumb landed hard on the concrete and slid across its smooth surface head first into a cinderblock wall with shattering velocity. There was a crunch of bone as his spine compressed and he lost about an inch of height. He didn't move again. He'd just been in a car accident without benefit of a vehicle. Blood seeped from his mouth. His shiv had fallen from his hand and clattered to the floor. D and Dumb, out for the count. Blood from their wounds pooled on the filthy floor, their last lines in the sand. Adios to the Texas correctional system. Actually, Mars didn't know if they were dead, and he really didn't care. Quads for life might be better justice. He looked up at Big Dick and called out, "That man got him a shiv too, sir. A lot of that going round. Best tell the warden." That's when the guards pounced, beating Mars with their batons until he went down, smiling all the way. Chapter 12.
Who the hell are you?
Melvin Mars had just awoken and was looking up from his hospital bed. Amos Decker stared down at him.
"You may be the luckiest guy in the world, Mr. Mars." "You trying to be funny?"
Mars tried to sit up, but his wrist was handcuffed to the bed railing, and it was a struggle because every part of him was hurting. His face looked like a balloon from all the swelling. Decker dipped his big hand under Mars's waist and hoisted him to a sitting position against the pillow. He pulled up a chair and sat down. Mars studied him.
"Do I know you?"
"Not unless you remember a linebacker at Ohio State that you humiliated about 22 years ago."
Mars squinted and looked Decker up and down. "I humiliated a lot of people on the field. You pretty big for a backer. You put on some weight?"
"About 100 pounds. You, on the other hand, look exactly the same."
"Who are you?"
"I'm with the FBI."
"You an agent?"
"No, I just work with them."
"Didn't know that was a thing."
"It's not really."
"Why are you here?" asked Mars.
"Because of your case, the recent development."
"Why is the FBI interested?"
"They are because I am," said Decker.
"Which gets back to my first damn question. Who are you?"
Decker held up his ID badge. "Amos Decker."
"Why did you say I was lucky?"
"'Cause I don't feel lucky." "Three reasons. Because someone came forward and confessed to the murders you were convicted of, you might be released. And despite the beating you took, you have no broken bones and no permanent injuries. Doc said your concussion was relatively mild, which means your head is very hard."
"And the third reason?"
"Two of the guards ratted out their colleague about the ambush back at the prison, so you will not be held legally accountable for what happened."
"What did happen?"
"One man dead, another man paralyzed."
"And the colleague, Big Dick?"
"Is right now being processed and jailed by Texas authorities."
Mars smiled and then laughed out loud, his split lip starting to bleed. "Damn, man, Big Dick on the other side of the bars? It's a miracle."
"Forget about Big Dick. You need to focus on you." Mars settled his gaze on Decker.
"Did we really play college ball against each other?
You remember when your Longhorns beat my Buckeyes by 5 touchdowns in Columbus?"
Mars smiled again. "Man, were you the one asked me how I did what I did?"
Decker nodded. "That was after your 3rd touchdown. Mars shook his head.
"What can I say? Worked my ass off, but a lot of it was God-given."
"God wasn't as generous with me."
Mars looked around. "Where am I?"
"After we heard what happened, we had you transferred to a hospital near your old home."
"When did you get here?"
"We landed about 6 hours ago.
"You keep saying we."
"I came with a team.
A team of FBI agents is interested in my case.
Why?
Just because some dude confessed? Is it that unique?"
"Unique enough, but it also had some parallels to another case."
"And what case was that?"
Decker said, "One to do with my family. You don't have to know the details, only that the similarities are striking."
"So that's why you're here?"
Decker studied him. He was good at sizing people up, but Mars was proving a tough one to crack. "Tell me about your parents."
"Where's the rest of your team?"
"You don't believe what I'm telling you?"
"I don't believe nobody about nothing."
"Believe him, Melvin,"
said a voice. Mars looked toward the doorway where his attorney, Mary Oliver, stood. She walked over to the bed and took his free hand as he sat up more.
"Thank God you're all right,"
she said, her eyes moist with tears.
I'm good, Mary. You know this dude? Mars asked, indicating Decker.
I just finished speaking with Special Agent Bogart,
she said.
Mr. Decker is the real deal, Melvin.
Decker added, we're here to try to figure out the truth. Mars sat back against the pillow.
The truth? After all this time, I wish you luck.
Luck may set you free, noted Decker.
Do I have to go back to that prison? Asked Mars.
Decker shook his head. After what happened, we're moving you to another place.
Where?
Federal custody.
What does that mean?
That means we're accepting responsibility for you. You'll have two feds standing guard over you while you rehab here. After that, you're in our custody until the outcome of your case is determined.
And the state of Texas is okay with that?
The state of Texas has its own problems,
said Oliver.
Namely, you can sue them for what happened to you.
Are you serious?
A conspiracy headed up by one of their guards nearly resulted in your murder. And then they almost beat you to death, so you have a plausible civil claim against them. And a criminal one against the guard and anyone else from the prison involved.
Decker said, I wish you luck with that, but that's not why I'm here. He looked at Mars. I'm here about the murders of your parents. Mars swiveled his head to stare at Decker.
What do you want to know?
Everything.
You got paper and pen, because it's a lot of stuff.
I have a good memory, said Decker. I don't forget much. The door to the room opened and Jameson came in. She had apparently heard what Decker had said. She held up a recorder. She said,
But my memory's not as good, so I always use this.
Alex Jameson, Melvin Mars, said Decker. She's also part of the team. They shook hands. Jameson said,
My colleague really wanted to take on this case, Mr. Mars. It's the only reason we're here.
Yeah, that's what he told me, said Mars, staring dead at Decker.
Tell me about the night your parents were killed, said Decker, as Jameson turned on her recorder.
If you're up to it,
said Oliver quickly, placing a protective hand on Mars's shoulder.
You took a real beating.
Mars said, I'm good. You want me to start at the beginning?
Yes. And Mars did. He talked for well over an hour. Decker frequently interrupted to ask a question or to clarify a point. When Mars was done, Decker said nothing for a few moments.
You were visiting a friend that night?
Yeah, like I said, Ellen Tanner.
Where and when did you meet Ellen Tanner? Asked Decker.
Mars frowned. What does that have to do with anything?
Right now, everything has to do with everything else, said Decker matter-of-factly.
Mars drew a long breath, licked his swollen lips, and said,
I met Ellen at a university alumni event the team attended. This was like a few weeks before. She was a big football fan, good-looking woman, fun, smart, we hit it off. We saw each other a lot, actually, and we made plans to see each other that night.
And you drove there?
Yes.
And what did you do while you were there?
We had a couple of beers. She had some pot, but I said no. That could blow my chance of playing the NFL.
Did you two sleep together?
She testified that we did.
What do you remember?
Asked Jameson.
We had sex, so what?
And then you left?
Yeah, I had a practice session with my trainer the next morning and wanted to get home and hit the sack. Then my car conked out, so I pulled into the motel and spent the night there.
Decker said, The thing is, the timeline provided by Tanner and the motel clerk does not coincide with your story. Mars rubbed his eyes.
I know. I heard them testify. All I can tell you is what I know. And I know when I left Ellen's place, and I know when I checked into the motel.
Decker sat back. Your credit card was used at a time that backs up the motel clerk's account, not yours.
You don't think I know that?
Barked Mars. I'm just trying to make sense of what, on the surface, does not make sense, and the last thing we need is for you to lie to us.
Mars suddenly jerked against the handcuff trapping him to the bed, but it did not give. Jameson and Oliver had jumped back, but Decker hadn't moved a muscle.
Mars sat back against the pillow, breathing hard.
I'm not lying.
Okay, replied Decker calmly.
And maybe you're not here to help me. Maybe you're here to make sure I stay in prison.